Hey everyone, you're listening to Affirmative Reaction here on SiriusXM and Progress Channel 127. I'm your host, Jorge Andres Olivares. Now, I'm going to start today's conversation with my next guest by reading a few names. Some you'll recognize, some you might not at the onset, but there's still names that we should be very much aware of, especially in the course of the conversation we're about to have. Those names are Elijah McClain, Emmett Till, Eric Garner, Breonna Taylor, Hadia Pendleton, Sandra Bland, Reverend Clementa Pinckney. Now, some of you have already heard these names. You've heard them for several years now. But it seems as though over the past few months, in the aftermath of George Floyd's death, that these names have become more prevalent. And that is both an unfortunate reason because of the fact that these names are something that we should be worried about. But it's also encouraging because we start to realize that we as a society are knowing that Black lives matter and that we should be focusing on making sure that we uplift our Black brothers and sisters here in this country. So I'm very excited to welcome to the program the author of a brand new book. Now, you've heard his voice not only on this channel, but in various outlets because he is one of the most foremost voices when it comes to talking about race and identity in this country. Now, Michael Eric Dyson is a New York Times bestselling author of several books, but he's also a distinguished university professor of African American and Diaspora Studies, College of Arts and Sciences and of Ethics and Society, Divinity School, and a centennial professor at Vanderbilt University, who we have looked towards in moments like this when we're trying to figure out if we can have this very necessary conversation about race in America, particularly when it comes to Black America. And he is the author of the brand new book, Long Time Coming, Reckoning with Race in America, because it's something that we've recognized over the past few months. That time is now. So very excited to welcome Professor Michael Eric Dyson to Affirmative Reaction. Thank you so much for joining me today, sir.
Thanks for having me, my friend. It's a great honor to be here.
I appreciate that. And I appreciate you taking the time to write this book because I can only imagine as somebody who is on the outside looking in, somebody who has never had the Black American experience, that the past few months have been incredibly difficult for you and for others who are members of the community. So let's just start off there and then and talk about even before thoughts of writing the book and coming towards having this discussion about your own personal feelings of how the past few months have transpired.
Yes, sir. Well, thank you for that empathy. Thank you for that understanding. And thank you for that acknowledgement of the trauma and pain that among others, but especially Black people have endured with our Latinx allies, with our indigenous allies, our Asian allies and brothers and sisters from everywhere. But the pain has been especially acute because the episode that was George Floyd's traumatic death, his brutal leave taking from this life, has been repeated time and again, has gone on since his death. The other day in Columbus, Ohio, with a young Black man going into the home that he shared with his younger brother and his grandmother. They were there and he was literally murdered by the police going in the door. He did nothing. He had no warrant for his arrest. There was nothing he had done against the law. As far as I can understand, this contingent of the police searching for drugs and the like, ended up a person from that task force killing him. And now this young man is dead. Again, we have to confront this horror and this tragedy. So it has been especially difficult. It was heartening that after, in the immediate aftermath of the death of George Floyd, America committed itself to dealing with systemic racism, institutional injustice, and how they could confront that in a holistic and healthy fashion. And yet, at the end of the day, here we are now 6 months later, and it's faded from the headlines. It's no longer leading the broadcast. There is no commitment to addressing systemic racism. It was as if it never existed. And I wrote my book to remind us that these people lived real lives and they died real deaths, and that we continue to not only mourn them, we continue to amplify their now stilled voices. We continue to uplift their now dead bodies And we continue to push forward in the name of those martyrs of a movement, not seeking to sacrifice their lives consciously, but who, having had their lives snatched from them, inevitably signify within Black culture a need to remember and to memorialize our struggle for justice in this country. So it's been an up and down. It's been a situation. It's been a very difficult one. Then when you factor in the global pandemic of the virus that has killed more than a million folk around the world, and so many more in this country than needed to die because of the malicious inefficiency and the vicious indifference of a president who would rather be a dictator and a fascist than a duly elected and sworn public servant.
It's so weird to put into perspective this idea that we're having this conversation in December, George Floyd's murder and the immediate aftermath, the uprising that took place, just the outrage that was associated with his murder, happened around Memorial Day. And so, like, to think how much time has passed since all of that started. And I don't think that, kind of to your point about the indifference of this administration, never heard anything from the Trump administration as to whether or not they empathized with the situation that took place, if they had any sympathy for the families of those involved, especially the names that I listed at the beginning of our conversation, none of that. And so it just kind of goes on to this idea of, we are currently existing and living in this white supremacist nation.
That's right.
That is unfortunately coming at our, we just aren't being able to support ourselves in the ways that we want to because of that infrastructure that's in place. I want to ask you about, because of the names that I mentioned, Emmett Till is in that list,
right?
Including Breonna Taylor, who's a name that we've unfortunately had to mourn in this year, even though we've tried to keep her memory alive in the course of doing so. But do you see a difference in those two memories at all, considering the amount of time that has passed? And for the most part, a lot of people who might not be of the Black American experience know Emmett Till's name. And even now, I'm sure a lot of people understand and know Breonna's name. But do you see more similarities than differences in those two cases, despite the fact that they're generations apart?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's a great parallel. And yes, I do see more similarity than difference. Obviously, Emmett Till was a 14-year-old Black boy from Chicago traveling down to his kinfolk's place in Money, Mississippi with his uncle Mose and his cousins, and was extracted brutally one night from his resting in their abode there in Mississippi, because allegedly he had whistled at or flirted with a white woman, Ms. Carolyn Bryant, who was a store owner's wife. And, word of mouth got around, one thing led to another. And young Mr. Till, 14 years old, who didn't really take seriously their threat to kill him, didn't think he was in trouble because he's from Chicago. And this is ludicrous, and this is not how we do things. Even there, though it's a radically segregated city, the kind of explicit viciousness that was manifest with lethal consequence and fatal results in the South more routinely than up North. Not that the North didn't have its own especially vigilant, vigorous brutalities. So he wasn't used to that kind of stuff, and thought they were playing, basically, because they testified to this later, after they were cleared in a kangaroo court, and then having been cleared because they couldn't be tried again, sold their story for $4,000 to a national magazine. It was a Look or Life, one of those, and said that until the end, he didn't believe that he was going to die, and he was more playful than they wanted him to be, and it angered them. And so here he was, 14 years old, brutally beaten, shot, had a cotton gin, a 70-pound cotton gin fan put around his neck and thrown into the river, Tallahatchie River. And then we have Breonna Taylor. Earlier this year, 26-year-old woman, EMT specialist, public servant, laying in her bed at rest, asleep with her boyfriend next to her. And the police come calling and, you know, a no-knock warrant, though there have been contradictory stories, but from what we can tell, a no-knock warrant, they end up, the boyfriend, not knowing it's the police, shoots in self-defense. Why? Because when Black people shoot in self-defense, it's a crime. And why would you do that? When white folk do it, it's acceptable and it's all good. Especially in open carry states, especially where they celebrate the Second Amendment, not as the Second Amendment, but the Second Commandment, nearly. And so, of course, that's problematic. And then they shoot back and then they kill Miss Taylor. And the tragedy is compounded by the fact that it's the wrong house. Or she's not the right person they're looking for. The person they're looking for is not there. He's already been arrested. And it is. And then finally, when justice was done, it wasn't done. The only one of the three cops to be held to account was the cop who shot errantly into an adjacent apartment of a white figure, not the adjacent apartment of the Black person. That didn't count. It's the adjacent apartment of the white person that they were held to, that person was, that policeman was held to account for. So again, in that sense, it was horror and tragedy, racially speaking. Emmett Till is lynched. Breonna Taylor is murdered, killed in her own bed. And white life is elevated above Black life in both instances, and the haunting similarities of losing their lives, one to a white vigilante, one to a white police person or policeman. And in our experiences, because we know the history, beginning in early 1700s, the slave patrols were established. They became the predecessors to our policing in America. And as a result of that, the pedigree of policing has always sought to contain and control Black bodies, brown bodies, yellow, and, you know, even sometimes poor white bodies, bodies that fall outside of the order of American justice as narrowly interpreted. So, yeah, I see a parallel there, a similarity there, the trauma, the hurt, the pain, the refusal to do justice, folk getting away with murdering without paying a price. There are haunting similarities.
I should note that each chapter of the book is dedicated essentially to one of the names that I mentioned at the top of the conversation.
A letter written to them, yes.
A letter written to each one. And the letter that's written to Breonna, the title of that chapter is White Theft. Right. And I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about that word theft, because there's another chapter that's called White Comfort.
Right.
And I do love that there's colors associated with each of the chapters. Yes. But let's talk a little bit about the usage of those words, theft, comfort, particularly because they come with that modifier. They have the white attached to it, too.
That's right. The adjective modifying those nouns. Yeah, white theft. From the very beginning, Breonna Taylor had her life taken from her, right? And that's a metaphor for how Black life has always been stolen, extracted from our resting place in Africa, brought forcibly against our will here to America, dying in millions on the brutal Middle Passage, getting into America where our labor was stolen, our bodies were stolen, our wombs were stolen, our sexual organs were stolen, our futures were stolen, and often our lives were stolen. And so that is a resounding metaphor for that process. And I talk about that in that chapter, going from enslavement down to present day, trying to give a historical overview and a genealogy of the origins of this idea of white theft, of Black existence, of Black breath, of Black bodies, and the ultimate, you know, in its appropriation, because white theft of Black musical styles, and which is why I talk in that chapter about the Black next and the white again, pitted against each other. Black people always looking for the next thing. You steal one thing from us, we're looking for the next thing. You steal one form of music from us, one form of culture, one form of expression, we're looking for the next. You block us in one way in terms of our quest for justice, we look for the next route to racial redemption. So the Black next is always up against the white again. No, again, we assert our authority. Again, we assert our power. Again, we assert our superiority. So it's the Black next against the white again. And they're constantly at war. and then White Comfort, that chapter is Sandra Bland. And Sandra Bland disturbed the comfort of the police, that they should be able to stop us and mistreat us without being spoken back to. They should be comfortable in their, you know, in their brutal mistreatment of us. And she spoke back to them. And the way in which she disturbed White Comfort is metaphoric as well. The same way we disturb White Comfort when white folk who are comfortable in their ignorance, don't know much about us, are not curious about who we are and what our livelihood is and what our expectations are and what our experiences are, institutionally and existentially, no understanding of that, no force that would compel them to know who we are. And the comfort of that disaffiliation, the comfort of that distance, the comfort of that refusal to recognize. So I wanted to measure the depth of that discomfort and the white quest for comfort as a means by which Black lives are often destroyed.
It's impossible to have this conversation, and you kind of just alluded to it right now. It's impossible to have this conversation without bringing in the police and authorities and in the role that they have in being uncomfortable with right. Black bodies. Right. And so there is a, especially in the aftermath of George Floyd's death and in Breonna Taylor's death, especially this year, that's when you saw the false equivalency. A lot of people tried to say that a Blue Lives Matter movement had to exist the same way as a Black Lives Matter movement.
Yeah.
So it's addressed in the fact that there's a chapter called Blue Plague, because there is this idea that we have these officers who have chosen the color blue for a variety of reasons, to have that be the thing that signifies them. So if we can talk a little bit about that, this idea that our understanding of policing is so different because of its engagement with Black folks.
Yes, no, that's exactly right. And look at the ontological obfuscation, if we can use such a barbaric term, ontology in terms of being, so a category of existence, and how it's being obscured because it's being compared to Blackness. Black is a state of race, so to speak, a racial identity ascribed by society to be certain, but something with which we are tagged and born. You ain't born blue. Last time I checked, you didn't come out the womb with a badge on your chest and a baton, that little billy club you might have and possess, you know, metaphorically, but you ain't born blue. You know, if you are, they'll take you to the doctor or keep you there and say, my God, there's something wrong. There's no blood that rushing to his veins or, excuse me, her veins. You are without blood. And maybe there is a bloodlessness to blue that we need to deal with. But to try to compare the race that one is ascribed, one is born with, one is born into, and a profession that one chooses shows that the philosophers are right. That's a category mistake. You're jacking the whole game up, and it's disingenuous and it's wrong. You chose to be blue. You chose to be a cop. You chose to be a police person. And to say Blue Lives Matter is not a parallel to Black Lives Matter. Blue Lives Matter means that pink lives matter. If you want to compare them to nurses, if they or the candy stripe or whatever they, you know, whatever color is associated with, or blue lives versus blue collar. But to talk about Black and blue in terms of a racial signifier and designation and an ethnic origin that can be subsumed under that and a kind of profession and vocation one chooses to pursue is just dishonest to begin with, and doesn't yield any insight. But what it does do, it galvanizes people who refuse to take a look, a hard, serious, long look at how the blue plague on Black people has been visited upon us routinely. That policing from the very beginning, from slave patrols in America in 1703 and 4 in Virginia, where they began and where they spread, where policing was to control, literally, arrest Black futures, arrest Black mobility, make sure that Black people couldn't travel freely from slave plantation to slave plantation. And if they did, they had to be held to account. Where are your papers? Where's your permission slip? Basically. So the blue plague in this country traces its genealogy back to the slave patrol. I'm not saying they're the same thing, but they have an organic relationship. And that attempt to control and dominate Black bodies, to make sure that Black people would be in place and that law and order would be the reinforcement of a narrow white perception of the appropriate place and manner of Black bodies in public, is what we have had to contend with from the very beginning. So in that sense, policing has been deleterious, destructive, and dangerous to Black people from the get-go.
We've had this conversation. I think the idea of race and identity has been in the forefront of our minds because of the Trump administration.
Right.
And because of the fact that we have witnessed white supremacist ideals, we saw Charlottesville happen, we saw everything that took place in which we understood that this administration just could care less about people of color. I'm curious your thoughts about, we are having this conversation knowing that President-elect Joe Biden will be coming into office in just a short amount of time. Are you afraid that the conversation that we were more willing to have against an administration that was so purely racist, that conversation is now going to be somewhat derailed because of this idea that we're going back to normal because we have a president that's somewhat, quote unquote, gets it?
Right. No, I think he gets it. I think his vice president certainly gets it. But you're right. You know, the temptation is to be lulled to sleep. We're woke. Now we're going to go back to sleep. We're awake, but we're going to go back to sleep. Because the thing people forget when they say they woke, you got to take a nap. You got to go to sleep. And what's going to wake you up? What's the alarm clock? Hopefully it won't be another Black person's death. Can we be awakened by far less severe measure and means. But yes, the backdrop of a neo-fascist, neo-Nazi driving, a neo-Nazi embracing presidency certainly heightens our call for racial justice. And we could be lulled to sleep under a Biden-Harris administration, but we've got to understand that even there, the more subtle forms of racial tyranny exist. And we have to be able to address them. Martin Luther King Jr. said, it ain't the white bigots who are giving us the biggest problem. It's the white liberals who think that they've already got it worked out. But, you know, as I've looked at Biden, I have to give Biden credit in this sense. He understands he's a white man. He understands he doesn't understand everything. And he understands, as he said in accepting when he was finally acknowledged by CNN and therefore the world, you know, called it for him, the news media, that he was president, he said, Black people, I owe you. You had my back, now I'm gonna have your back. I ain't never heard a president say that. Now, it remains to be seen what he's doing, but he's made some, you know, he's stuck to his word in terms of diversity, in terms of choosing cabinet members, I think more than Obama, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe trying to match up with Clinton. So here's a man who is taken seriously within his purview and his worldview as a centrist Democrat, the necessity of engaging racial justice at every level. And he's got a feel for it, you know, his entire life. Now, yes, he's had some very problematic racial escapades. Who hasn't among white folk? So we're not going to hold them to, this is why, and I know we'll get to this, I challenge cancel culture. I don't want to just cancel somebody because they disagree or they've had some mistakes in the past. Call them out for it, hold them accountable. But let's allow people the space to be forgiven or to be redeemed and to see the light of the day and to move forward. And I think in this sense, we've got to take full advantage of an enlightened, engaged administration that is ostensibly open to many of the issues that we think are important. And we got to exploit that to the fullest.
I mean, I think I'm hoping that the next few months and hopefully the next couple of years when we're into a Biden-Harris administration that we start to understand that these conversations are not at all something that are topical, not topical, right. but in the sense of like,
right.
somehow
right.
it's only brought up at a particular moment and then you That's let right. it go away and then come back. And
trendy, very trendy.
Trendy is exactly the word that I'm looking for. But I do want to remind our listeners, this is an incredibly emotional book because you understand, obviously, the feelings that come into it, considering the conversation that we just started off with, where Professor Dyson was talking about just how difficult the past few months have been because of what we've seen. But I highly recommend you pick it up because it is part of this conversation that needs to continue to go on, especially now that we have a new administration. It is called Long Time Coming, Reckoning with Race in America. It is by Professor Michael Eric Dyson. Sir, thank you so much for your time, and thank you so much for your just candor and ability to talk about this with me at a level that we have.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you for your great work. Thank you for your courage and your cutting edge and pioneering investigation of the convergence of sexuality, of racial identity, of ethnicity, of culture and class and nationality. It's a beautiful thing. Continue to do a great work, my friend.